With a new year on the horizon comes a new Congress. Item one on the agenda, reopen the government. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios at Colorado Public Radio in Denver, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, December 31st, New Year's Eve. Great to have you with us. As 2018 draws to a close, parts of the federal government remain closed for business. Some 800,000 federal workers have been furloughed or are working without pay at the Departments of Homeland Security, Commerce, and Transportation. Members of the U.S. Coast Guard were due to receive their final paychecks today until the government reopens. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams joins me now from our Washington Bureau with an update and a look at the year ahead with the new Congress. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Amy.
Where do things stand with the shutdown at this point? I mean, is there any hope for a resolution in the next couple of days?
I mean, we're pretty much where we have been, you know, since the shutdown started. That President Trump wants one thing, the Democrats want something else, and there's not necessarily any meaningful movement towards a deal. It seems that there's been pretty clear indications that this can is being definitively kicked to the next Congress, which, you know, starts luckily just in a couple of days. And there's already talk that the Democrats are planning to introduce a new spending bill once they take control of the House on Thursday. But that's unlikely to include the kind of wall funding that President Trump wants. Therefore, it's unlikely that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell will bring it for a vote, which means we will again be where we are now, unless something else happens.
So you mentioned this new Congress is taking over with Democrats in control of the House. What are some of the spending priorities you expect to see in the coming year?
Well, I think whenever they do pass a new spending bill to end this partial government shutdown, it will hopefully include some back pay for the furloughed government workers and the workers who have been working without pay. But let's keep in mind, a lot of the talk has been centered around just passing another continuing resolution. That is to just mainly keep the funding where it has been in the past so that they can have more time to negotiate a real spending bill. If that happens, you know, we're still going to see more contentious fights with the newly divided Congress over how these agencies are really going to be funded moving forward. Obviously, the Republicans and the Democrats have some different priorities in those areas.
What other economic themes might we see come up in this new Congress?
Democrats in the House say that they want to start with ethics and campaign finance reform. But again, it's unlikely that that's going to go anywhere in the Republican-controlled Senate. And I think we're going to see a lot of this because honestly, with the House and Senate so divided on so many issues, it's unlikely we're going to see a lot of big legislation get through this year. The tax cuts made it through with one-party government, and that was a big piece of legislation. There does seem to be some bipartisan support to do something on prescription drug prices, but again, unclear if there's enough political will for folks to cross the aisle on even issues where people agree.
You mentioned the tax law that passed with only GOP support. The legislation that did make it through, the tax cuts, the spending bills, contributed to record deficits in the national debt. Any sense that that's going to be taken on this year?
I think we're going to hear a lot about it this year, but it's something people love to complain about, especially when they are not in power. So it's, you know, despite the fact that a lot of this debt was accumulated in the last year under Republican control, I think we're probably going to hear a lot about the ballooning debt and deficit from Republicans this year, just like we heard a lot about it from Democrats last year. And so we'll probably hear it. Whether or not anything gets done about it, that's less likely. The current debt limit expires in March. It can probably be fudged a bit until the summer or the fall, but that's probably going to be a flashpoint for some of these debates. And then in September, there's a deadline where Congress has to decide whether to relax budget caps as they have done in the past. Again, probably going to be another fight then.
And of course, all this is going to be happening in the run-up to another presidential election. How does that change the equation?
It's like we're always in campaign mode, right? I mean,
yeah.
So
I know. Didn't we just finish one?
Yeah. But look, we're going to have a lot of people, especially senators, on the campaign trail. That means that all of these votes, all of these talking points, people are going to be weighing how voting for or against particular legislation, what they say about something, how it's going to play into a potential presidential run. And President Trump is going to be doing the same thing because he's up for re-election in 2020. And so a lot of members of Congress will be thinking very carefully about how their votes play in 2020. And I think that is going to determine a lot of the economic narrative we hear out of Congress in 2019.
Okay. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams in Washington. Thank you.
No problem.
And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, Amy.
As the calendar flips over to 2019, what's ahead for the global economy? That story tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report. And on Wall Street, the worst year since the financial crisis comes to an end. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. More than 17 million workers in the country will wake up tomorrow to a happy development, a higher paycheck. Starting the new year, 20 states and 21 cities throughout the U.S. are raising their minimum wages. This at a time when the federal minimum wage hasn't grown in a decade. And wages in general have barely budged, despite a very tight job market. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more.
In theory, wages are supposed to go up when unemployment rates are low and companies are desperate to fill positions. But wages haven't been increasing by themselves, says Teresa Ghilarducci, a labor economist at the New School.
The labor markets are tight. Wages at the bottom have really been slow to increase.
She says because companies have gotten more powerful, a ballot measure or new law is sometimes needed to force companies to raise wages. Still, Ghilarducci says minimum wage hikes don't necessarily lead to higher incomes across the board.
So you might increase the pay of people at the very bottom, but supervisor pay, the people that supervises them, their pay may not increase.
And while minimum wage workers will see an increase in those 20 states, David Newmark, a professor of economics at UC Irvine, warns against equating low-wage workers with poor workers.
You do have poor single mothers and the like, but you also have a lot of very low-wage teenagers who are in middle-class families or even higher.
He says the problem for many people in low-income families is that they don't have jobs at all. Even with low unemployment rates, labor participation is low.
If we want to help low-income families, and I think we should because inequality is a big problem and poverty is a big problem, we should use policies that target them directly.
That's not to say that minimum wage hikes have no real effect at all. Orly Ashenfelter is an economics professor at Princeton.
The minimum wage will have a real effect in the lower-wage states.
That's states like Arkansas, Missouri, and Ohio, where a lot of people earn the minimum wage. While pay is also going up in higher wage states like California and New York, Ashenfelter says employers there already tend to pay above the minimum. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coal mining companies and power plants that burn coal are trying to sort out the implications of a new proposal from the Trump administration. On Friday, the EPA began the process of rolling back a regulation on the air pollutant mercury. The toxic metal can cause birth defects and learning disabilities, among other health problems. For now, the agency just wants to revisit its findings. Talk about DC wonky. But critics suspect a longer strategy to relax the regulation and raise the bar for future environmental rules. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports from Washington.
Limits on mercury pollution took effect 6 years ago, but Friday, the EPA argued they were not appropriate and necessary. If that stands, the coal industry would have a legal foothold to challenge the curbs, says Joseph Goffman, a former top official at the agency. Power plants have installed machines to curb the pollution, but they could turn them off.
There's a good chance that some companies will stop operating the equipment in order to save money. That will make coal-fired electricity at least a little bit less expensive and may help increase the demand for coal.
Coal executive Robert Murray, a big donor to the president's inauguration, is widely reported to have written up a Trump administration deregulatory wish list. And John Walk at the Natural Resources Defense Council says
these mercury and air toxic standards for power plants were very prominently on that kill list.
What's also at stake is future regulations. The EPA often balances costs and benefits when it writes regulations, and now it wants to limit how to tally health benefits. For instance, power plant machines that filter out mercury also filter out soot and other nasty stuff. But these, quote, co-benefits would no longer count, says law professor Rena Steinzer at the University of Maryland.
It is a radical departure from the way that costs and benefits have been calculated, not just under Obama, but back under George Bush, back to Clinton.
Welcome to the regulatory weeds. But she says the upshot is this could make future environmental rules much harder to pass, which is what conservative proponents of this change want. They argue that the Obama EPA overreached. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Think sand, and you might have visions of lying on the beach, especially those of us living in colder climes right about now. But sand is also a key ingredient in concrete. And in the state of Texas, sand mining is big business. In the city of Houston, there are concerns that companies digging for sand along rivers contributed to the disastrous flooding that region saw from Hurricane Harvey. Now, in an unusual move for a business-friendly state, Texas lawmakers are considering new restrictions on the industry. Travis Bubenik has the story from the Marketplace Hub at Houston Public Media.
Harvey's flooding along the San Jacinto River ripped some homes completely off their foundations. The storm also flushed huge amounts of sand down the river and piled it up on the banks. If you want to see it up close, you first got to scramble through some thick woods.
Now we just climbed vertically 15 feet of sand.
Matthew Berg's my guide. He runs a one-man flood risk advising firm called Simfero Consultants. He says even before Harvey, this place was loaded with sand.
If you look at the sands that are under our feet, you're talking almost 300 feet deep. So deep, deep geological deposits of sand.
That natural bounty has increasingly attracted companies that gather the sand and sell it as an ingredient for concrete. Nationwide, it's an almost $8 billion industry. Locally, it's the largest industrial activity along one fork of the San Jacinto River. Rob Van Til's with River Aggregates, a local sand mining company.
Anything that has construction, any type of new construction, is going to have sand in it.
The company's product eventually winds up in
all your roads, all your homes, all your hospitals, all your churches, all your schools.
All around us, excavators are digging huge mud pits. The mud gets cleaned up and sent off to concrete plants, like one owned by a company called Police Construction. Ed Mears is a manager there.
The demand for concrete and the use of it is, ingredients definitely is increasing here.
The Texas Demographic Center expects the Houston region's population to grow by more than 5 million people over the next decade. So sand's in high demand. But some are now blaming the industry for making Harvey's destruction worse.
Do I feel that the sand mining operations contributed? Absolutely.
Houston City Councilmember Dave Martin says the company's mine too close to the river.
What in essence happened during Harvey was uncontrolled water coming our way, grabbing sand, and then bringing it down and deposited it into our backyard.
He says because of the buildup, the river couldn't hold as much water, so it flooded farther into neighborhoods than it would have otherwise. The industry disputes this. Van Til says Harvey's flooding didn't wash sand away from his company's mine to other areas.
The water comes in very fast, but it leaves fairly slow. So we really had no loss of material, no loss of anything leaving the property other than water after Harvey.
And Van Til says the sand pits even held back some of the floodwaters. Texas lawmakers are expected to tackle the issue when they meet in the new year for the state's legislative session. One proposal would create a new inspections program, require a hydrology assessment for mine permits, and make it a crime for companies to falsify records. Republican Governor Greg Abbott has already instructed state regulators to crack down on existing rules. Still, as to what the science tells us?
Well, it's hard to say.
University of Houston sand expert William Dupre.
We know that in some aspects they're not a problem. They even be a benefit. We know in other aspects they are a problem. What we certainly don't know is the net impact. Because it's like a lot of things, like urbanization, like building dams, they are both a problem and a benefit.
As the industry hums along, the local flood district is planning more research, and the different sides are lobbying lawmakers. In Houston, I'm Travis Bubenik for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we are not primarily here because of too many trips to Starbucks.
Working most of your life and unable to retire. But first, let's do the numbers. On the last day of the year, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 265 points, 1.1% to close at 23,327. The NASDAQ picked up 50 points, 0.7%, to finish at 66.35. And the S&P 500 discovered 21 points, 0.8%, to end at 25.06. It's also the last day of the month, the quarter, and the year, so time for a little review. In December, the Dow lopped off 8.6%. The NASDAQ fell 9.4%. The S&P 500 declined 9.1%. It was a rocky quarter. The Dow lost 11.8%. The NASDAQ shed 17.5%. The S&P 500 declined 13.9%. For the year that was, the Dow was off 5.6%. The NASDAQ was down 3.8%. The S&P 500 lost 6.2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
December 31st is coming up fast, and that means time is running out to support Marketplace and make your gift go twice as far. Donate today to invest in news you value and trust, and your contribution in any amount will be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at Candida. Now's the time. Go to Marketplace.org and make a gift in any amount to become a Marketplace investor today. And thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Not that long ago, Somali piracy was one of the world's biggest security concerns. It even inspired that Hollywood movie, Captain Phillips. But in recent years, piracy along the African coastline has pretty much dropped off the news agenda, due in no small part to international efforts to combat it. The European anti-piracy operation, codenamed Atalanta, turned 10 this month. The BBC's senior Africa correspondent, Anne Soy, got a firsthand look at how it's working.
I am on board a Spanish warship on the Indian Ocean off the coast of Somalia. This is part of the European Union effort to keep these waters safe. It's an important sea route for global trade. 6 to 10 years ago, pirates operated here with impunity. But the presence of warships like this one's have helped to deter piracy and to suppress it. Some former pirates still live on the Somali coast. We met one of them in Hordia, in the northern region of Puntland. Like many others, he was initially a fisherman.
I had a boat and a net on it. Then a trawler cut our fishing nets and pulled them away. Our fishing equipment was destroyed. I was left with an empty boat. That's what angered us.
We are now approaching the village of Isle. A helicopter is hovering in the sky. Nothing is left to chance here. The security is very tight. For many years, Isle was the epicenter of Somali piracy activity. It's a tiny strip of sandy beach set right in front of a dramatic cliff.
The local police commissioner, Mohammed Yusuf, says they're only just growing their coast guard. And they've still got a long way to go.
We don't have enough boats to take to sea. We have only two small boats, but they don't move fast.
But the presence of warships has made a difference. Rear Admiral Alfonso Perez de Nanclares is in charge of the EU naval operation here.
When the mission started, we got about 40 different ships hijacked and more than 700 people hijacked as well.
It's now down to 2 unsuccessful attempts this year. Admiral Nanclares ordered the destruction at sea of the boat used in the second attack.
Piracy has been contained, but I really think that the intention of going back to this business is still there.
And so the warship patrols continuously. Breakfast has been cut short, and there's increasing activity in the bridge. This is where the officers observe what is going on out in the sea. And we're told that there is a fishing dhow that has been spotted. And the officers are now preparing what they call a friendly approach. The boats have now slowed down on the water, and I can see the officers are getting onto the fishing dhow.
The boat is from Somalia, and the crew is from Yemen.
Once the officers are sure the boat is safe, we are allowed to board it. Osman Ali has fished here for 6 years.
Sometimes we meet bad people who steal our tools and fish, but the presence of the warship has made things better.
I ask if he's seen any pirates.
No, but there are fishing trawlers here.
Those foreign-owned trawlers are a real cause for concern. They were blamed for forcing fishermen into piracy in the first place. The EU mission has succeeded in suppressing Somalia's piracy problem, but the conditions that fueled the attacks have not gone away.
That's the BBC's Anne Soy for Marketplace. After a lifetime of work, millions of Americans are reaching the age of retirement, unable to retire. More than a quarter of baby boomers, roughly speaking, people who are 55 and older, have no retirement savings. And many of those who do don't have nearly enough saved to stop working. The changing job market, low wage growth, and rising costs of living have all played a role. Elizabeth White has been on the front lines of all this since she wrote an essay called You Know Her that went viral. It detailed her own experiences facing the retirement crisis. Now her new book is called 55, Underemployed and Faking Normal. Elizabeth White, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Part of your title, Faking Normal, comes from your own experience with underemployment. What made you decide to write this book?
I've had a really cool career, worked at the World Bank, was an entrepreneur, and then the 2008-2009 Great Recession hit. I went from a very good income to zero. At a point of just despair, I wrote an essay, and that essay described what it's like to land here. Since it's not yet really a national conversation, and all the stories we have on retirement are the beaming boomer clinking champagne glasses on a cruise, or they're eating cat food under a bridge. There's sort of no middle.
But the middle you found was a lot of people like you who had been very successful and suddenly found that the job market wasn't working for them and they didn't have enough retirement savings.
Right.
What did you find has led to this phenomenon? Was it a matter of individual failure to plan and to save or something systemic?
We all could have saved more, and I always say that. So there's absolutely an individual aspect. But when there are tens of millions of people who have landed here, and you look at things like disappearing pensions, escalating cost of housing and health care. And I tell people, if you rifle through my life, you'll see all kinds of, you know, a dumb thing I did here or there. But we are not primarily here because of too many trips to Starbucks.
And you mention in the book that it's much worse for women. We're expected to live longer and on less money. Even Social Security benefits are smaller for women, and especially for women of color. Why is that?
Well, we are often in and out of the workforce, taking care of children, taking care of parents, not getting the same kinds of advancement opportunities. This sort of inequality accumulates over a lifetime. And so you have higher numbers of women, 65 and over, living in poverty or destitute.
You offer a lot of solutions in the book, but some of them might be a little bit hard to swallow for people who have had successful careers and may not want to apply for food stamps. But you write that only a third of seniors who qualify for food stamps actually apply. What are some of the surprising fixes that you found?
I had to learn to get off my throne. And this is not easy when, you know, you've just been comfortable most of your adult life. So I tried to look around at opportunities that are out there, both in housing and income. And when it gets very dire, like food stamps, because many of us are going to have to really take a hard look at how we live and do we need a roommate. And altogether in the book, I think I counted 125 online resources that I've identified.
You wrote this viral essay. You had a really successful TED Talk, and now this book. How are you doing now?
You know, it is still a bit what I call feast or famine. The light that I see at the end of the tunnel, I now don't think it's a train barreling down on me. It's not a path I would have chosen, but I feel like I'm on the path I'm supposed to be on.
Elizabeth White, she wrote 55, Underemployed, and Faking Normal, Your Guide to a Better Life. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And this final note, is it parody or trademark infringement? That's the question behind a legal battle between the French luxury brand Louis Vuitton and a California toy company. MGA Entertainment sued Louis Vuitton on Friday for interfering in sales of a toy purse for children called Poopsie Pooey Vuitton. I wish I didn't need to go into detail, but the handbag is poop-shaped and filled with little packets of slime powder to make rainbow-colored unicorn poop. The toy maker argues its purse is protected parody designed to mock, criticize, and make fun of the wealth and celebrity associated with Louis Vuitton products. Though I must say it comes with a plenty steep price tag for a toy, $59.99. And we've got to go. Today, the Dow rose 265 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ picked up 50 points, 0.7%. The S&P 500 rose 21 points, 0.8%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, Daniel Shin, and Phoebe Unterman. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Amy Scott. Have a great New Year's Eve, and we'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.